Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of a fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip. Through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com.
Welcome to the Backstep, where we talk about safety, survival, and other things. Welcome to the Backstep.
Good evening, everybody. This is Ronnie K in New York, where it is so cold. How cold is it? I saw a dog stuck to a hydrant this morning on the way to work, Tom. But what can I tell you? It's we're in a deep freeze of northeast winter here, and tonight here in New York, just north of the city where I live, it's going to get down to about somewhere between a balmy 5 and 10. So what's going on out west, buddy?
I'll be thinking of you. It was 60 degrees when I pulled into Albuquerque about 10 minutes ago, and it's supposed to get down into the 20s tonight, but it's supposed to warm up again tomorrow.
All right. That sounds pretty par for the course out there. As you know, my sister lives in Albuquerque for many years.
Was that you
up?
Running lights and siren in the intro?
What, what you just heard?
The new intro.
Yeah, well, we got a new sponsor, and that was our good friend Peter Perkilo doing that intro, and he wrote me this afternoon saying, hey, don't hit the button for your music until you hear my intro, and then after the siren, you can go. So that was that. But, we have another new sponsor for the show, and it's about there's cancer prevention meshes and, you know, wipes and all that good stuff. And so, you know, take heed. You know, don't be just to everybody on the air. Don't be a big shot. Take care of yourselves. Keep yourselves clean, especially after a good job, and wash your gear and shower up and all that stuff. So it's important you do that so we can all be around for a long time and tell silly, stupid stories. That's what we do, right? We tell a lot of stupid stories. We love stupid stories. But in all seriousness, it's about longevity and passing on your experience. I mean, really, it kind of comes down to that. You know, interestingly enough, Tommy, Bobby Halton's editorial in the February Fire Engineering, he talks about how things evolve in the fire service and how he's been around FDIC for so long and been part of running it for over 20 years already. And he says one of his learning experiences every year is the hundreds of proposals that come in to do classes. He says, and they've seen trends over time. They've seen trends come and go about, you know, how many. And he says for the longest time, he says, you know, when it became big, you know, RIT and FAST teams and rescue teams and all that stuff, just, you know, every year there was 1,000 of them. And then it kind of became a way of life for the fire service. So those proposals kind of tended to die off. You know, certain things are institutionalized and entrenched. And, you know, we talk about them all the time. He talked about the back to basic classes that, you know, just for years and years, and that comes and goes. That's a common, you know, when we don't see it for a while, it comes back because we forget about our basics and we got to get back to it. You know, get water on the fire, you know, get hook up the water supply, get water in the building. So, but now he says the biggest thing that's come along in these many years and has stayed is leadership. He's seeing more leadership constantly every year. Different styles, different kinds, different interpretations. And I thought it was neat because, as you know, Tommy, I'm a leadership guy. I've been doing something to call leadership excellence for probably about 20 or 25 years. And I've read so many books. I'm actually reading a book now. It's by hold on a second. I'll tell you in a second. It's right over here. Admiral William McRaven. that Admiral McRaven is the one, his video on YouTube went absolutely viral. He did a keynote at a graduation. Did you see that?
Is it the Make Your Bed one?
Yeah, that's the guy. Yeah, this is called The Hero Code. The name of this book is The Hero Code. But and it's kind of one in a series. And, yeah, he did the one called Make Your Bed. And his that keynote that he did on YouTube was just absolutely mesmerizing. I just sat there with my mouth open listening to this guy. It was great. But the leadership thing never seems to go away, which is a good thing because, listen, with the fire service especially, you know, we always talk about we have to turn over the whole thing to the next generation, you know, and there has to be leadership involved because we've seen so many failed systems, not only in fire and emergency services, but in the world, you know, corporate. You know, there's hundreds of cases of big corporations going down in flames because of the lack of leadership and all that stuff. So leadership, you know, Bobby kind of hit it on the head with the fact that it keeps coming. It's like it's the gift that keeps on giving, like they say, you know.
Yeah.
And it was good to hear it. You know, I know you're a leadership guy as well, you know.
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, with the way that seems to be very cyclic, I bet you could pull a new leadership text and it'll relate back into something that was written probably in the turn of the century. I mean, it's been such an important piece of what we do. Unfortunately, there's a lot of, especially in the newer officers, that they kind of hit that by trial and error. And I certainly remember as a young company officer having to learn some of those lessons the hard way. And then I started paying more attention to what was being published out there. And a lot of it made perfectly good sense.
Yep, and you know it's not always a fire service book. You know, interestingly enough, in my last command, but before I went back to the city, to New York, I was a chief of Connecticut, and I was given promotional exams, and for captain, I liked a good fireground strategy and tactics book. A good safety book and a good leadership book, you know. So I kind of sent out an email to, I don't know, 100 of my closest friends, like they say, you know, what do you recommend, you know? And it turns out I got some great suggestions, and I said not necessarily fire service, and I got some great suggestions from around the country. And interestingly enough, the book that I use, Bobby Halton actually said that there's a book out there. You'll have to excuse me because my age is starting to show. I can't remember the damn title, but I'll tell you what it was about. It was about the explorers, like Shackleton and those guys, Shackleton Amundsen, that tried to conquer the North and South Poles, and they talked about those qualities of the leadership that those expedition leaders demonstrated, the ones that had a real true grip on the leadership skills and all the stuff that we talk about, trust, care, integrity, character, all that, the ones that really dug in and did that brought their people back afterwards. The ones that didn't have that kind of leadership plan, halfway there or all the way there, they never came back. You know, a really interesting read. So, of course, you know, my darling's in the firehouse. I give them this book to read, and they're stopping in my office. Everyone's going, what does this have to do with being a fire officer? I said, oh, man. I said,
you know,
other than the fact it was an unbelievable, interesting read, just reading about the expeditions going to the North, the South Pole and all that. I said, go back and read the book. And it wasn't a big book. It was, you know, it was kind of skinny. I said, look and study the leadership qualities and the leadership concepts of what these guys, what the successful guys did and what the guys who didn't come back did. And that's your lessons learned. I had to explain the lessons learned. But after a while, they kind of got it. But it was one of the better books. I mean, Yes, the one I, the, my current favorite one, what's his name? The guy who was the Allied commander in Afghanistan, General Mattis, Jim Mattis. He wrote a neat book on leadership. I took a lot of stuff out of his book, and I actually updated and enhanced my lecture. And there's one called Leadership in Dangerous Situations. That one is written by a couple of West Point PhDs, and then they brought in different guest writers in certain chapters. Chief Pfeiffer from New York City, who was the 9/11 chief, he did a piece of a chapter. And that book, I bought after I read it, I got bookmarks in about 65 pages. And again, I updated my leadership lecture with some of that stuff. I bought a dozen copies, and when friends of mine get promoted to kind of like into the chief officer ranks, so assistant chief, deputy chief, and chief of department, I send them that as a congratulatory gift. You know, congratulations on your promotion. You made it, blah, blah, blah. Now read this book.
So, yeah.
You know, so it's not always, you know, Ralph the fire chief who wrote a book on, and some of the leadership books that come out of the fire service have been pretty good. But some of the other ones are just, wow, because, just as long as you're around, as long as I've been around, which is 1,000 years, you read some of this stuff and say, wow, what a concept or what an idea or you know, whatever. You know, and there's still plenty out there. But like you said, you know, if you pick up a book or you get the written word on the subject, and it's like, wow, there's a lot of stuff out there I could learn, you know.
You know, I go back to my EFO days. And, you know, we got a reading list for the first executive leadership class. And one of my favorites that came out of that was Iacocca's book, just some of the stuff he was able to to pull off, some great lessons in leadership there. The other case study that really stuck with me, and his name popped up when I was reading The Fires, is Robert Moses,
right?
The planner from New York City, and some of the stuff, even though it seemed a little slimy after I read The Fires, some of the stuff that he was able to accomplish in trying to get the road system and some of the other stuff in New York City done. That was an absolutely amazing look at that.
You know, there's a book just on him. It's called The Power Broker, and that's a famous kind of like a biography that was written about him. I think after he passed away, he might have been around. I don't remember, but it's big. It's like a 1,000-page soft-covered book called The Power Broker, and it talks about how he brokered all these deals and made all and you know. Really got down and dirty with the state government, you know, getting federal funds, state funds, and building the roads. Like you said, the road systems in around New York City. Yeah, he was powerful and slimy all at the same time. I mean, he did stuff. He built the roads going out to Long Island. Okay, we have a couple of major roads. We got the Long Island Expressway, but then on the southern shore is the Southern State Parkway, and then you have the Northern State on the northern shore of Long Island. And for those of you who don't know about Long Island, New York, it's a long island. Thank you very much. And it runs about 80 or 90 miles out to Montauk Point. But the what he did on those, which were built before the expressway, was the overpasses. He built them too low on purpose so that the inner city people couldn't get on buses and go out to Long Island and spend the weekend or go to the beach. I mean, he strategically built those roads to keep buses off of those roads so the people in the inner cities couldn't go out to Long Island. So, I mean, that's the kind of the slimy side of them, you know. And then eventually they built the LIE, and that you can take, you know, front to back and all the way out. And there's, you know, if there are overpasses, they're taller. And it was done later in time. So, but, yeah, there's I mean, we could talk about leadership all day and all night. I mean, I can anyway. But there are some great books out there, folks. So you want to take a look at General Jim Mattis's book. He was the Supreme Allied Commander in the Middle East, and he was a Marine, a 4-star general. He worked a little bit in the Trump White House, and then they had their falling out, you know, like the president did with a lot of other people. But his book, he talks – my favorite quote out of Mattis's book, my favorite quote, and I use it now, and I kind of twist it toward the fire service, is what he said was – he said not the troops. What did he call them? I'm just tired, Tom. I'm just tired tonight.
Senior moment.
He said basically what he was saying is like an army moves, you know, at the speed of trust. And that's what he called it, the speed of trust. The troops move at the speed of trust. And I said, wow, to talk about it, that's such a profound statement.
Yeah,
you know, if you break it down, it's like, you know, your people will move in that direction and get whatever it's got to get done and let nothing stand in their way if they trust you. You know, so things move at the speed of trust. Maybe he said tactics. He might have used the word tactics, move at the speed of trust or whatever. But at any event, so there's some really good stuff, that leadership in dangerous situations. There's some good leadership stuff out there. So I urge anybody and everybody who may be listening to get outside the fire service and take a look at some of the leadership books that are out there now. They're terrific. Terrific. Absolutely terrific. So anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
After the triple line of duty death in Baltimore, and a city I'm not entirely unfamiliar with, since the guys from D.C. dragged me up there to buff every once in a while. But, you know, I got to thinking of the state of the city, I guess, kind of rang home to me as to the fact that, you know, you got three firefighters that made the supreme sacrifice in a building collapse, and the number of vacant buildings in that city never ceases to amaze me. But I got to thinking about, you know, the social impacts and all the rest of the stuff going on, and I actually went back and started reading a book called Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets. And it was written by a journalist in Baltimore who spent a year riding with the homicide guys.
Wow.
And it again becomes kind of an eye-opener if you look at some of the social ills, if you would, that kind of just feed on that city, and kind of relate that back to some of the social impacts to the fire department. It's a mess, and it's a political mess. I look at some of the bigger cities and some of the fire problem that we see, not only from the aspect of the line of duty deaths, but look what just happened in Philly and what happened in your own city, Ron.
Multiple
dead in Philly, and it just I can't remember the last time we saw big numbers like that. You know, that one came down, and the cause was a 5-year-old that lit a Christmas tree on fire, which, as we know from looking at the NIST videos, how much of a problem and the release rate that goes along with that. But there were no working smoke detectors in there. It's 2022.
Yeah, exactly.
What are we doing?
I agree with you, and then not far after that we had the fire in the Bronx. Fire in the Bronx was January 9th. And said we lost 17 people up there, and it was a nutty scene. The guys did as best as they could be expected. What they said, you know, on the history making side, the thing that everybody was talking about was the fact that the fourth alarm chief, when he called for the fourth, his instruction to the companies coming in, he told the dispatcher, tell them to leave their rigs on the perimeter, grab their medical bags, leave all their firefighting equipment on the truck, just bring your medical bag. They had an MCI. It was a legitimate MCI. They had 65 patients, 68 patients. You know?
Yeah, nothing like getting nothing like getting thrown in the middle of an NCI and then have a multiple alarm fire to go along with it.
Yeah, but you know, they did as well as could be expected, and along with the EMS division. But the side story to that is the firefighter who was driving the chief that day. Usually the chiefs show up with an aid at a fire, especially like a fourth alarm. And they, you know, it's a radio and a clipboard, and they're tracking everything, and they're working the radio for the boss, and the boss is trying to, you know, do his thing. And I spoke to him the weekend after the fire. He said, number one, he's a 30-year guy, never seen anything like it in his life, 9/11 aside. He said, number two, he said, I was doing CPR on patients out in the street, which is like, that's like, not that it's unheard of, but it's so far out of the norm for the chief's aide coming into a fourth alarm to be doing CPR on a patient in the street. He said, I was doing CPR on multiple victims like in the course of an hour. He says it was complete nuts, you know. But yeah, and that's my thing, you know, we come in Monday. And we start talking to the bosses, and we start looking at the video, and you know, and then we look at the building, and we see how when it was built and how it was built and all that stuff. You know, we get into our fire prevention mode, you know, and the engineering side of things and all that. And we one of the things I said is, God, it's 2022. How can we have a fire like this? You know, I mean, I guess the unfortunate part is, in every big city, the housing stock is old.
Yeah.
You know, this building was built with federal money in the 70s while the Bronx was burning, while Harlem was burning. They were pouring federal money in to rebuild some of the neighborhoods, and they put up these buildings with federal money exempt from the New York City code. You know, there were some ratings, some fire ratings that were not even as agreed upon with the city, were never installed and stuff like that. So there's, you know, it's when we look at the fire problem, you know, I was just talking about the other day, Tommy, we were talking about the Truman Conference, which is going on this week in San Antonio. You know, President Truman was that kind of the first one to really talk about fire safety in America. And then fast forward to the Nixon years when they did the America Burning Project. And then 25 years after that, they did America Still Burning. Okay,
yeah.
And now America is still burning. So it's like, you know, what the hell? When does it end? You know, and of course, the people in the fire business, you know, aside from you and I, were saying, well, it's not, you know, we don't see the end, and everybody's not. How I say they're happy? We're not happy about it. You know, we don't want to see anybody get killed in a fire, whether it's our own people or civilians. But it's hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel. It's very hard to see it, and what my take on most of what we're talking about is, you know, we say, well, sometimes you sit back in your chair and say, the fire marshals of North America, you know, every fire marshal, fire inspector, fire prevention bureau, you know, it's like, some people say, why are we wasting our time? What the hell are we doing? We're not making a difference. But I think, you know, in my little tiny opinion here, that imagine how bad it would be if we weren't doing anything.
Oh, my God.
You know, imagine if we weren't doing plant examination, testing sprinkler systems and flowing standpipes every 5 years and all the stuff that fire marshals and fire inspectors do all year round in all corners of the United States to make sure that these systems are installed and they're working and doing code enforcement and to clean up your rubbish and here's a violation, make sure this is working and make sure your fire doors close and all the stuff that we do in compliance with the code. Imagine if we weren't doing any of it. So I never buy that argument like, well, what the hell? Let's pack up, fold up our tent and go home and last man out, shut the lights. It think of how much worse it would be if we weren't doing it at all.
And that's a hard number to quantify.
Very hard.
Because you basically solved part of the problem, but you got nothing to show for it. You know, we could log the fact that you were there at a certain time and a certain date, and you performed these tests, and it gets documented. But how do you know whether that was effective enough to make sure that a fire didn't start?
Right, because this, you know, it's we've been thinking about how to quantify how many fires were prevented this week, you know, and we've been talking about that since the beginning of time. We're still talking about it, and it's hard. So the only thing we use to measure is has the fire problem gone down? Has it gotten better? Are we having less fires? All that stuff. And then when a fire does break out, did the fire protection systems function as they were? And, you know, over the weekend we had five multiple dwelling high rise fires on Saturday and Sunday, okay, in the city. And I'm listening to hear if they say on the radio we can't get water out of the standpipe system. That's the part that, you know, that's the part I'm involved with now, and that makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up if I ever heard that on the radio. So we, you know, and we tell our inspectors, you know, don't give up and don't think that your work is mundane, because you can get trapped in that real easy. You know, go to a couple of tests each day, go to buildings, watch the water, you know, flush the water out of the Siamese, have the contractor back flush the system onto the street, get all the crap out of it, pressurize it, make sure it's holding, check the gauge, do an inspection of the building, move on to the next one. You know, while that may seem routine, it's not routine, because at 3 o'clock in the morning tonight, you know, you go home at 4:30 in the afternoon, tonight at midnight, there's fire on the 15th floor of that building. The firefighters got to get clean water out of that standpipe. They got to open that valve and get water so they can make a difference. So while sometimes we think the work of the Fire Prevention Bureau anywhere and everywhere, and I'm not, Tommy, you know me a long time. I'm not preaching this because that's where I'm working now. But I've been like this my whole life, my whole career. I've been a fire prevention guy when I was in the firehouse for 30 years. This is part and parcel to who we are and what we're supposed to be doing. And a lot of firefighters can't be bothered, and we hate inspections, and we don't want to do pub ed. But it's part and parcel to what we're supposed to be doing and how we're supposed to be doing it. But I shudder to think that if we weren't doing anything, how much worse it could be, you know?
Now, you were the guy that tuned me into the fact that fire prevention saves firefighters' lives. And, you know, I never had put it in that context before. But, man, that's a pretty powerful statement.
Well, I firmly believe it. It's obvious if I put it on you and I said it, because I've had it on my email sign off, you know, for many years, you know, in different jobs, you know, because it does, you know, and we've in New York City, where the firefighters are kind of busy, you know, and they go out and do building inspection, but it's hard because they get interrupted a lot, you know, a couple of million EMS calls a year and all that other stuff. But any chance we get, we tell them, you know, when we're out there doing what we do in the bureau, it's, you know, we're out there serving the citizens and the firefighters. When we do plan examinations, you know, Tommy, on an average year, our plan examiners are looking at 20,000 fire alarm plans a year.
Wow.
And that's a combination of new and renovations. You know, I don't know what the ratio is, new to renovation, probably a little more renovation, but they're looking at 20,000 prints. And that could also be, we're going to add 3 horns and 4 strobes, you know, or we're going to add 3 more pull stations. But it's 20,000 applications a year. And those little things, you know, count, you know, and we're going to, you know, we give orders to install sprinklers in certain areas and or extend the system or whatever. That we tell the firefighters when our examiners, our engineers, our civilian engineers, they're all PEs, when they're looking at those systems, they ask the question, will the firefighters benefit from this and how can they benefit from it? And if they don't like what they see, they won't approve it. You know, wait a minute. You know, you got a riser here, and you know, it's a standpipe system, and blah blah blah. But the stretch is going to be too long and too thin from that. You got to put a second riser in, buddy boy. Well, we're not sure the code says that, and they'll fight, you know, fight with whoever they got to fight with to get the second riser put in, or at least a set of auxiliary outlets halfway down the hall for the long stretch. So we have made big headway convincing the firefighters that they're our customer as much as anybody else. And I think the fire marshals, inspectors out there that are doing it everywhere in the country need to be doing it the same way. I had a great fire marshal when I was the chief in Wilton, Connecticut. because on a daily basis, as the shifts were changed day to day, the lieutenants and captains were always walking by my office going into the back. So either the guy was taking numbers or they were talking about stuff, you know.
Yeah.
It was a steady stream of officers going to the back room. But it turns out I got up a few times to go in there myself to ask them a question, and they were looking at a set of plans. You know, my line
cool.
officers were standing with the marshal looking at a set of prints. That we were doing not a ton of construction, but they built a couple of retirement homes, a couple of senior residences, and some other commercial stuff. And they were genuinely interested in what was going up, and they were going to take the company out and go take a ride over to the construction site. And they would spend time with the marshal, or if he saw something, he'd come back and report it right away, or get on the radio and say, "Hey, you guys better come out here and take a look at this." So, you know, that relationship with the fire marshal's office and the line is critical. I think it's critical, you know, and it's unfortunate because in a lot of big cities or urban centers, like the firemen, they don't want to be bothered with the fire prevention guys. You know, it's like, you know, you guys just, you know, you do your thing and don't worry about it. But no, the answer is we do worry about it, you know, and sometimes you just need to know what the heck's going on out there. It's one of interesting dynamic, to say the least, you know.
Oh, yeah. So
I got a couple of hot topics here. You got a hot topic you want to throw out?
I just wanted to point out one thing in that whole Baltimore mess that, you know, I think we have completely evolved to make sure that women are included in the fire service when we start seeing them pop up as line of duty deaths. But Kelsey Sadler was the acting lieutenant, I believe, on Engine 14 when she was killed in the collapse. And she was promoted to lieutenant posthumously after the fire. And you know what that stuff means to me, that, you know, it's a true honor for the department to do that and shows how much they consider taking care of their own.
Yeah, I agree with you. The other part of it is let's promote our people while they're alive, you know, and that's nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's nothing disparaging against the lieutenant, of course. Of course, it's not disparaging against, but we need to do everything we can to be smart on the fire ground and make sure that, you know, we can get promoted the right way. They did the same thing to the two police officers that were murdered in the city 3 weeks ago. They posthumously promoted them to detective. Right, you know, at the funeral, the fire commissioner, the police commissioner kind of does that. And what it also does is it bulks up the widow's pension quite a bit from patrolman to detective. So, but let's all strive to get promoted, you know, while we're here. You know, versus any other way, because you know, while it's an honor, and those three firefighters went down with honor, but that it's certainly not the recommended thing, and we want to keep our people around as long as we can. You know, the other thing, Tom, is again we weren't at the scene, you know, and what do we always say to our brothers and sisters who weren't there, like we weren't? Keep your gun holstered. Wait for the investigation to play out. You know, don't start, you know, everybody is, you know, becomes an expert sitting at the keyboard. You know, they become keyboard warriors, and how come they were in the building? We do know a couple of things. The building had a fire in 2015, and it was condemned by the city. You know, so they you know, so then there's always the faction. What the hell were they doing in there? You know, we weren't there. I wasn't there. You weren't there. But let the investigation play out. We'll figure out what happened, and hopefully we can learn some lessons from this to try to avoid it in the future, you know. So, and you know, with all due respect to our three firefighters who we lost in Baltimore. So one of the things that's kind of popping up lately that we're having issues with, and we're assuming that all the other jurisdictions around the country, you know, from cities and towns to big cities, whatever, is the lithium-ion batteries. So, number one, to our listening audience, if you've never seen it, Google lithium-ion battery scooter fire or bicycle fire. There's a couple of hundred videos out there. I looked at a couple of videos recently, and I was absolutely blown away. No pun intended. Nah, pun intended. I couldn't believe how that little battery pack overpressurized, took off, and then exploded. And it really, it's actually, if you haven't seen it, it's equivalent to a dry Christmas tree blowing up in the living room. Same thing. And one of the issues that we're having around the country is after people are buying these battery e-bikes and e-scooters and all that stuff, and when that battery that comes with the unit, which is a UL-approved battery, it's been tested, it's solid and all that, they're buying knockoffs coming from overseas at half the price, and there's no quality control at all with those. So that there's two things here. You have the power companies that are building these huge battery storage facilities for backup power and alternate power and all that stuff, which we kind of get for a greener society. And then there's the individual bikes and scooters in apartments and all that stuff. So last year, statistically, Tom, in New York City, we had 110 structure fires from e-bikes or scooters in the city of New York.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
And a couple of multiple alarm fires. Did you see the YouTube of the two kids that went out the window and shimmied down the pipe next to the building?
No.
Did you catch that?
Not that one. I saw the one that Billy G posted the other day, and I think it was London Fire Brigade that was showing what the lithium batteries were doing prior to the fire department's arrival.
Right.
And
we had a multiple alarm, multiple dwelling fire, and it got so hot so fast. Two kids, grown kids, they went out onto the window ledge on an upper floor and shimmied down a pipe to get out of there. I think it was in the Bronx,
wow,
if I'm not mistaken. But we had a couple of fatal fires, a couple of multiple alarms. So as we look at the problem now in New York City, and it's all over the place, there was a big battery storage bank from the power company in Surprise, Arizona. And a perfect name, because, boy, did those guys get a surprise when they pulled up. They were actually went over to the storage building, if you will. It's a freestanding building, you know, in the yard.
Yeah.
But when they opened up the door, it exploded. And it sent three guys to the hospital, and one of them was in really bad shape, really bad shape. They think he's going to survive. So this lithium-ion battery thing, you know, we could take precautions with our power company. You know, they got a lot of trained people, and, you know, we learned to stand back and blah, blah, do this, do that. But the bigger problem is, you know, the guy charging 4 or 5 or 10 bicycles in a storefront or in an apartment on the fifth floor. You know,
yeah,
and guys went into business, like in the city. You know, I'll charge your bike for $50 a month, drop it off here every night. So guy has 40 bikes in his living room. You know, that kind of stuff. That's the stuff that's going to bite the fire companies in the butt, not just in New York City, but anywhere, because these things became big and popular overnight.
Oh, yeah.
Overnight. I drive through the city every day, and just scooters and some of them look like they're not as big as a Harley, but some of them look like a full size motorcycle, and it's actually battery powered. You don't hear them coming up the street. You know, it don't sound like a hog. Look like a hog. Don't sound like a hog. You know, and smaller versions like mini bike size, electric, and then a regular bicycle looking bike with a battery on it. And then there's the little scooters that people are driving around, the scooters, you know. So they're everywhere, man. And this has become, and it's going to get worse. It's only going to get worse. The age of this lithium-ion battery. You can't put them out. They've put them out, and they've stuck the battery in a bucket of water. And 8 hours later, the water's boiling in the bucket. The battery takes off again, and it's boiling the water in a bucket. So there's a whole host of issues and problems. With these batteries.
The issue with the Teslas was I think they tried using 30,000 gallons of water to put out one of them that was on fire, and they were not successful. But what they've discovered is the brackish water that has some salt content seems to assist in fire suppression. And I'm sure somebody's going to do a paper on it, but I haven't seen it as of yet. But I don't know, limited access highways, you're not going to find 30,000 gallons of water out there in the middle of nowhere when one of these things starts lighting up.
Well, frankly, what I've seen, they had a 2 weeks ago, the FDNY Chiefs Association hosted a full day on this stuff. And had some really, really big experts come in. In fact, one guy was a lieutenant in the city. He took on, everybody finds their niche, right? So he took on the lithium-ion battery thing, and then he worked in fire prevention for a while, looking at these bulk systems and all the batteries. So he really became a kind of an expert in it, and now in retirement, he's got a little company, and he's consulting on lithium-ion battery safety all over the country now. He did well for himself, this guy, but he knew his stuff. And he did the entire morning, and we had probably the bulk of the audience were battalion chiefs. Probably had over 100 battalion chiefs in the room, and a couple deputies and some other staff chiefs in there as well. But what we heard is that putting water on these doesn't necessarily work. And what we also heard was, if it's going, let it go, and let it burn itself out. Let it if it's burning and you don't have exposure problems. And you don't have anything around it, you know, a car on a highway, there's no exposure problems. You know, just let it go. Let it do its thing. Because if you manage to get it knocked down, okay, you got a monster hazmat on your hands. And then what do you do with batteries that are halfway burned or halfway – what do you do with them? Okay, and we've had some of these batteries come back 36 hours after they were allegedly out, and they stopped burning again in a metal can that you got it in the back of the firehouse out in the yard somewhere. So, you know, the recommendation is if it's going, let it go and let the, all that crap burn itself out, and get rid of the fuel, and then you got to figure out what to do with the burned up housing, which is a little easier than all the crap that's left in there. So, we actually had a couple of bosses from the sanitation department. Because they're the ones that are going to end up with it at the end of the day. Even we call out hazmat, and hazmat maybe is going to bundle it up somehow. They are using a material right now called cell block. And the guy from cell block was there, and it almost looks like a glass beads, if you will. And what happens is when you put this on top of the battery, the glass melts and encapsulates this whole battery and it's done. So then, okay, so you have an encapsulated battery. The fire never comes back because it's encapsulated. What do you do with it?
Yeah.
what landfill don't you throw it in? You know, kind of thing. So, our hazmat guys, they're working with this cell block company, and they've used it on some stuff, and it seems to be working. But, you know, a little bit of technology there. But this is a problem throughout the country, and I don't doesn't matter who's listening to this or if they're listening, whatever part of the United States they're in, you have a lithium-ion battery problem, because it's not just, you know, the e-bikes and all that stuff. That's the biggest stuff, but you know, laptops and iPads and your wristwatch, and you know, it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then of course you got storage systems that are coming your way, because everyone's looking to live in a greener society. So. This is something that you got to start looking. If you're not looking at it yet, you got to start looking at it. We're about to release the 22 code in New York City. we got a whole bunch of stuff on battery storage and, you know, lithium ions and that kind of stuff. So don't know where that's going to lead to.
It didn't really hit home to me. And, you know, when I quit smoking, I actually used a vape pen to try to take the edge off of that. I've given that up since, but I can remember charging that thing up and sticking it in my pocket, and all of a sudden, I'm paying attention because my pants are on fire. So even the little batteries tend to have some issues.
Oh, you're right, because the afternoon after lunch there was a couple of guys there from a company called Hazmat 3 is the name of the company, and one of them was a battalion chief out of a city on the outskirts of Chicago, one of the smaller cities. And he was good, but he said it's not just the big lithium ion battery pack or the one that's in the bike. And he kind of started with, you know, the batteries, you know, double A's, triple A's, 9-volt, you know, started that small and then worked his way up. And then he even talked about the lead acid batteries and the big dry cells and the stuff that you find in a uninterrupted power source in a computer room somewhere in an office building. He says, you know, let's not ignore those. They're still batteries, you know.
Yeah.
So his thing was like all batteries could be bad. Let's take a look at them one at a time. So, yeah, I get that. I didn't know you were a victim of a pocket vaping fire. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I investigated my own fire.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that's what you do best, man. I just have to know when it got hot, like you realized what was going on. Did you kind of just jump up and yell "Great balls of fire"?
No, I wasn't thinking that clearly.
Okay. Yeah. You would have done Jerry Lee Lewis very proud if you did that. You know? Great balls of fire. Okay. So I guess to continue on our health and safety track, this is Heart Health Month. Last month was Firefighter Cancer Awareness Month, and this month is Heart Health Month for firefighters and everybody else. So I think it's worth spending a minute or three, based on last month's theme. Hopefully what our firefighters are doing is taking a little bit better care of themselves and being more aware. This is all awareness stuff, but you know there's a lot of stuff written already on cancer awareness, and again we talked about before, you know, deconning after a job, deconning your turnout gear, taking a shower, wiping off your neck, getting your glands cleaned, and all that stuff. You know, the absorption rate, as we know, is 400 times greater when your pores are open and you're sweating and that kind of stuff. So there's got to be so you got to have some sort of plan in your fire department, in your firehouse, and all that stuff. And there's enough on it out there where you can get your hands on it and have a bit of a program. And nobody's immune to it. You know, you don't have to be big city to do it. If you're a small town, if you're a volunteer company and you have a couple of fires a year, well by gosh, I mean, after that fire, you know, do what you're supposed to do. You know, decon yourselves outside, wash yourselves off. Get your gear off, you know, get back to the firehouse. Don't you know, it looks all salty and tough. Those days are over about looking salty and tough. You know, get back, get washed, jump in the shower. You don't want to take it home with you either. If you have the facilities at the firehouse and even a volunteer company, if you got a locker, keep some extra clothes in there. You know, get showered up as soon as you get back and you get your rigs back in service. And then bring that stuff home in a bag and you know, plastic bag it and just wash it by itself or nothing else, or have it done professionally. But when I talk about this stuff about like cancer and all that, I always tell, especially younger audiences like probationary firefighters or just, you know, younger firefighters, I said, listen, the goal here for my generation is to help you wipe this out so your generation doesn't have to live through it. You know, the goal is when they print the essentials of firefighting or Fire Engineering's Firefighter 1 and 2 manual or all the other publishers that publish that initial book when you go to probie school 25, 30 years from now, they're supposed to be writing, we used to have a cancer problem in the fire service. It went away. We don't have a cancer problem anymore. It's far and few between, but our gear is better. This is better. Our firefighters took care of themselves. They put their nose to the grindstone and we licked it. So that's the goal, you know, to talk about cancer in the fire service as a thing of the past. You know, that's so now we're into Heart Health Month, and there's a good friend, you know, I know Tommy. We talk about the Gary Critchbaum. Gary is the new program director for the First Responder Center for Excellence, FRCE, and they do a lot of great stuff with cardiac and cancer, and he's working on some grand programs that you're going to see surface up shortly. But I talk to Gary about every other day. As a side note, folks who are listening, As you know, Tom and I have wrapped up with the Fallen Firefighters Foundation and the Memorial Weekend, and Gary's one of our senior staff members that helps us run the Memorial Weekend as the deputy IC. But he is now the program director for the FRCE, and he's already working on some great stuff. So keep your eyes open for stuff coming out of the First Responder Center for Excellence on cancer, cardiac, and all that kind of stuff. There's another resource for you to go to the FRCE to get some stuff. There's no shortage of stuff.
Yeah.
If you go on the net, there's plenty of stuff. You can find stuff everywhere, you know.
I was, was not pleasantly surprised, but, when Billy G came out and started talking about the you guys basically having the same cancer issue, I think it heightens the awareness a little bit. And, you got two guys that I know, the two Jewish guys in the American Fire Service.
There we go.
I think that you guys being transparent about it is going to make things better. It's going to head stuff in the right direction.
Well, it was interesting. Mine was 4 years ago. Sorry, 5 years ago. And after a while, Billy and I had some chats, and I wrote something. I published something on it, just a quick. I think it was one of my blog entries, and then he called me and said, "I'd like to use this in the things that I do, And it was one of his entries in I think maybe Firehouse for a little bit of exposure. So listen, it could, kind of happen to anybody, and you got to get checked, you got to get tested, and of course now. He just had it, and he kind of made a big deal, and he published it, and he by the way, Tommy, did you see the website he put together called the 40 Plus?
No, I have not.
Yeah, it's a website called 40 Plus, and he tapped about a dozen of us to make a short 2-3 minute video, stressing you got to get tested, get a blood test, chest your PSA. he told me what his numbers were, and I'm not sure if he's ever published that anywhere, so I'm not going to say what his numbers were, but his numbers were high enough where it could have done him in. They caught mine early. I caught mine really early. My Gleason score was a 3.5, but his was way, way up, and I'm not sure if he published that number, so I won't say it. But he was damn close to really having a real problem. But he took care of it, thank goodness. There doesn't appear to be any spread. And he's back to work. He's doing his thing, And but yeah, I think sometimes, not unlike the guys who have mental health problems or whatever. It's about giving back something. So. People can learn from it or look at it and say, gosh, maybe I need to do something here, And this is an easy one. Prostate cancer is easy. You take a blood test once a year for, every firefighter should be taking a blood test anyway annually, whether it's through the job or through your personal doc or whatever. And all they got to do is check for something called PSA. And the PSA gives you that number. And if it's steady and it's low, you're okay. And if it starts to climb, it tells you that you could have prostate cancer. And if you get it early, like I did, it's certainly survivable and all that stuff. So I think it's another one of those things to keep a lookout for. And I think Billy. I just read his whole story. We spoke on the phone 3 or 4 times. Just afterwards, I got a, of course, nobody knew, and I got a text from him, hey, can you give me a call when you get a chance? So I gave him a call an hour or two later, and, hey, what's up? He says, hey, guess what? It's that kind of conversation. Guess what happened to me?
Yeah.
And then we're on the phone for around an hour and a half, but he's doing well. He's doing well, and like I said, he's back to work and going to fires again and all that stuff. So you can't, it's about early detection. And that's what anything we're talking about. It's Heart Health Month. That thing about having chest pains and like, nah, it's nothing and it's indigestion. Somebody said to me a long time ago, we, us firefighters, we're big on denial, and denial's a river in Egypt, right? denial's a river. You don't feel
well,
good.
It was, it was when I was traveling, and we were at the one of the command staff meetings in Baltimore for Memorial Weekend, when I noticed I wasn't feeling right, and made the appointment with the doc when I got home, and sure enough, it was like, well, you're off to the cath lab, and that's how I wound up with the stent.
Yeah.
But it was one of those deals I could have just said, that's probably a little odd,
right.
We'll just keep
right.
moving on.
Exactly. Exactly. And knowing you, you probably said, well, I don't want to get the stent. I'd rather pull a stunt, knowing you. You'd rather stunt than stent. But, you have to listen to, you have to listen to your body. That's what it comes down to. You really have to listen. And as you get older, as the folks that are listening to this, as you get older, your body talks to you louder. It actually screams at you most days, so you have to listen to it and do what needs to be done. So let me see. Blah, blah, blah. Just real quick, we're winding down here, Tom. Our time's about up. I just wanted to send a tip of the helmet. A good friend, Jimmy Smith from Philadelphia, he's celebrating 34 years as an author for Firehouse Magazine. And I thought that's worth saying something,
Oh, yeah.
34 years sharing people. His knowledge, he spent 30 years in Philadelphia. And they're a kick-ass department. They get a lot of work. He has a ton of experience. He teaches at the NFA. He writes prolifically. But they did a little. I was passing through Firehouse online yesterday or today, and I saw something on there. I opened up the article, but tip of the helmet to Jimmy Smith from Philadelphia. 34 years as an author for Firehouse, and that's quite a side job for 34 years. So congratulations to him. Congratulations to him. Good guy too. Both of them guys that come out of Philly, they're pretty good guys.
Yeah. And, of course, we lost the icon with the passing of Dennis Smith.
Dennis Smith, yep, yep.
He did a lot, not only with the books that he authored, but I think he was the founding editor of Firehouse.
Yeah, it was his magazine. There's actually a great story that I read about how he tried to get it started. He beat the bushes to get backing, to get financial backing from corporations, from wherever he can get it to get the magazine off the ground, So he actually, it was his MIG. He actually started it. But I have my original copy that I bought in 1974, I'll say, of a report from Engine 82. It was a soft-covered, softback book. The pages are yellow. They're actually yellow now. But I have my original copy of Report from 82. Yep. And that did it. I read that book. That was it. But
a lot of us were in that position of what an impact that story had on everybody.
Well, yeah. And Report from Engine 82. And then this Emergency, the television show in this early 70s.
Yeah.
Between those two things, if you were... If you were even thinking about it, those are the two things that pushed you over the top. So I'm glad you mentioned Dennis Smith because, he was one of our modern founding fathers, and then not only wrote some really neat books, a couple of novels, a couple of fire service novels, just stories, and then a lot of truisms, and he did another book after 9/11, of course, but did a lot of legislative work. Did a lot of stuff in Washington and, to make the job better and that kind of stuff. So, hats off and a kind of a impromptu moment of silence for Dennis Smith as one of our icons in the business. I'm glad you mentioned that, Tommy. Thanks. I know you're traveling, Tom. I know you're on business investigating fires as you do. I don't know if did you put a roll call together tonight or were you
–
is that not it? You did. So why don't you go ahead and do that, and then we'll sign off. Okay, buddy? Go ahead.
All right. So we were last on the air on January 3rd of 2022, and there have been 18 line-of-duty deaths. On January 4th, Donald Gross from Lincoln, Nebraska, had a heart attack after a fire. Also on January 6th, Brian Bush from the Mineral Point Fire Department in Wisconsin was killed in a vehicle crash. Again on the 6th, John Flagler from the Los Angeles County Fire Department became trapped in a residential structure fire. Jim Ludlum from Mineral Point Fire Department in Wisconsin as well was killed in the same crash as Brian Bush. David Spink on January 9th was struck by a vehicle. He was with the Barstow Fire Protection District in California. Benjamin Polson on January 13th with the St. Louis, Missouri Fire Department, killed in a collapse at a structure fire. Billy Steinberg from Forestburg, New York, on January 15th, had a heart attack on the fire scene. Bobby Jones from the Reason Community Volunteer Fire Company in Westminster, Maryland, was a COVID death. Excuse me. On January 23rd, Julian Wilson Jr. from the Fayette County Fire Department in Somerville, Tennessee, also a COVID death. On January 24th, Lieutenant Paul Buttram from Baltimore City Fire Department, Kenneth Lako, firefighter with the Baltimore City Fire Department, and Lieutenant Kelly Sadler from the Baltimore City Fire Department were all killed in a collapse at a row house fire. On January 31st, Max Fortuna from the Stockton Fire Department was shot and killed at a dumpster fire. Excuse me. Mike Brooks from the Nashville Fire Department in Tennessee on February 1st passed from COVID. Austin Smith from the St. Paul Fire District in Oregon was killed in an explosion at a barn fire. James Radford from the Polly Watson Volunteer Fire Department in Fremont, North Carolina on February 5th. Mr. Radford had a heart attack while driving his vehicle and crashed. February 7th, Brian Miller from the Buckeye Valley Fire District in Buckeye, Arizona, a COVID death. And John McGuire from Copperas Cove Fire Department in Texas on February 10th, also a COVID death. As always, let's keep the brothers and sisters in our thoughts and prayers and heed the lessons they left before them. That's all I got, Rob.
Okay, that's plenty. Thanks, Tom. Okay, so until we're up on the backstep again, take care of yourselves, everybody. Be safe. Don't forget, drive slow, slow down, buckle up, eat right, eat light, stop for red, use your head. Watch how you drive, arrive alive, hug your wife, hug your significant others, your moms, your dads. Tell everybody you love them because that's what makes the world go around. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. Love you, Tommy. Take care, brother. We'll see you soon up on the back step. Good night, everyone.
Happy VD to you.